This is a trimmed down podcast version of Tracks of My Life from RNIB Connect Radio. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life, from maybe that first track they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest today is Richard Lane, a medical science journalist who worked for The Lancet for 19 years and may be one of the only blind wine teachers out there, having qualified as a wine educator with the Wine and Spirits Education Trust in 2021. Hello, Richard, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
My pleasure, Toby. Thank you for inviting me.
Richard, your first track takes you back to the age of five and a piece which is, I think, a Mendelssohn violin concerto, which accompanies a vinyl story LP of Robin Hood. and before we come to the actual sort of talking about Mendelssohn's violin concerto and the Robin Hood stories, I wondered, could you take me back to that early five-year-old Richard and what life was like for you growing up at that age and where you were living?
Well, sure. You know, searching in the depths of my memory, Toby, we're talking 50 years ago, but I do remember it clearly. I was a very happy, inquisitive young boy, so I was probably no different to most other five-year-old boys. I was living in Bedford. I was born and brought up there. I was at school there. That was my hometown, the centre of my universe. Bedford's a market town 50 miles north of London. Busy house because both my parents were doctors, both GPs, general practitioners, three older sisters, usually two or three dogs. So it was pretty busy, but I was always a bit of an early riser. I used to like getting up early in the morning and drive my sisters crazy by putting records on, you know, sort of before breakfast and sort of disturbing the household. I'd also just at that point got my first pair of National Health spectacles because it was clear I was short-sighted even at that young age. And that was a bit of a novelty. I think I quite enjoyed the kudos of having specs at age five, not realising what was going to come later. So yes, I think I was a chubby-cheeked, blonde-haired, five-year-old rushing around with specs on, driving everyone a bit crazy.
What was it about both Mendelssohn's violin concerto and the story of Robin Hood that sort of kept you hooked for all these years, Richard?
Well, Toby, you know what it's like when you're that age, impressionable clearly, and there's an awful lot you don't remember from when you're five, but the things you do remember, there seems to have been some sort of connection or some sort of penny dropping, as it were. And the penny dropped for me because it was a musical family that I was brought up in. My father was a good amateur musician. My two of my three sisters were very keen sort of violin and viola players. The piano was always being plonked. So I think I was encouraged, being the youngest, to try and engage with music. And one thing my parents did was I just sort of took it for granted, but I had these LP discs that were children's stories, you know, so things like, you know, Camelot and all the usual stuff and Robin Hood, but they had pieces of music attached to them. And I wasn't sure whether I fell in love with Robin Hood before the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto or whether it was the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto that got me in touch with the Robin Hood story, but they both coexisted on one of my storybooks. So it was the story of Robin Hood that we all know that requires no explanation. But I just remember so clearly putting the record on and you'd just hear the opening, the wonderful, something exquisite about the opening of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, that gentle little orchestral, couple of bars introduction, E minor, beautiful key, and then this exquisite, expressive solo violin coming in. And to me, that was A, wonderful in itself, and B, that was the introduction to the wonderful story of Robin Hood, who wanted a better deal for as many people as possible. And I was just very taken by that. So that's why Mendelssohn and this violin concerto, which I've heard performed many times, I've even attempted to play bits of it on my own violin, you know, has just been with me for 50 years.
Mendelssohn's violin concerto there, and a marriage between both music and storytelling that seems to be timeless. We now come to, I think, a hugely significant piece of music for you, Richard. One that you have played a couple of times, once with your sister and your dad, and another time in your blindest life, as you say. How vivid is that memory of playing this piece of music with your sister and your dad at the age of 12, I think?
That's right. The piece in question is Mozart's Miraculous Sinfonia Concertante. Sounds rather grand, but basically a Sinfonia Concertante is a sort of cross between a sort of, I suppose, a concerto and something a bit more orchestral. That's what Mozart had in mind. And as we've discussed, you know, I was brought up in this very keen amateur music, sort of musical family. And one of my elder sisters, Sue, who is 8 years older than myself, very good viola player, still is. But so when she was in her late teens, maybe, well, maybe 20 or so, I was 12. And my own violin playing was, you know, which had started at quite a young age, was reasonable at that stage. I guess I was sort of grade five, grade six or something, that sort of thing. By the time I was 12, there was this piece of music, the Mozart Sinfonia Concertante, that my father particularly, he was absolutely adored Mozart. We had a painting of Mozart overlooking our grand piano in our lounge in our home in Bedford. And clearly, you know, it didn't mean so much to me at the age of 12, but there was this piece that I heard my sister and my dad playing, and I liked it. And then my sister Sue said, well, when you're a little bit older, you'll join in and play with us, because it's for violin and viola and piano. And so at the age of 12, I just remember going in, you know, I don't want to make this sound formal. It was not a formal household. It was a very loving, carefree sort of environment. But I do remember my sister saying, now, look at the slow movement. And if you look at letter F in the slow movement, let's try and play this bit. In other words, this was a slower, slightly more playable bit, given that I wasn't particularly a strong violinist at that point in my life. But that was my first initiation, if you like, to this miraculous piece. So I was able to play with my sister, older and better, on the viola, because the violin and viola have very much equal status in this piece. And my dad playing the orchestral reduction, it's called, on the piano. And that in itself was quite funny, because my dad was no pianist. He tended to use two fingers, and the other hand was usually holding his pipe that he was puffing away on, you know. So it brings back wonderful memories. So that was the early thing, aspect to it. And then coming almost full circle just a year ago, because one thing I started doing in my blind life was to memorize pieces. We'll pick up on that in another piece later on. And so I challenged, I suppose challenge is the wrong word, presented the idea to a friend of mine, John Shaler from Bedford, who was one of our music tutors when I was an adolescent in the Bedford music system. He was a very good viola player, teacher. I said, I saw him and said, John, how do you fancy? He said, oh, Richard, how's your violin playing going? Because he knew I was doing a bit of playing in my blind life. And I said, well, John, how do you fancy playing the Mozart Sinfonia Concertante and performing it? He said, do you know what? He said, I've never performed it and I'd love to. So there you go. And so we worked on it for about 6 months during lockdown. We tried to do Zoom rehearsals because he was in Bedford. I was living in Surrey. So we couldn't meet up because of COVID and stuff. And he started trying not to boss me about too much, but he is a teacher. You know what teachers are like. And anyway, we got it into a reasonable state. And a year ago, we performed it in Farnham when I was living there with my friend Muriel on the piano playing my dad's orchestral reduction, but playing it much better than my dad did, bless his heart. And we performed it to about 100 people. And it was just a really, really important moment in my life, taking me back to my sighted days, but also to those days of sort of late childhood, early adolescence, and the lounge in Bedford with my family.
Mozart Sinfonia Concertante there, and a memorable piece for you, Richard, and two very good performances, I think, too, for you. We now come to the early 1990s, and when, as you say, you started your time as a blind person. If it is not too hard to maybe talk about, would you mind telling me a bit about that time? Was it hard for you coping with your sight loss, or were you able to get through it, and was work hard at that time as well?
Yes, so I certainly don't want to give the impression that it was easy. because it absolutely was not. The sight loss happened over a period of about a year, really, due to constantly sort of detaching retina in my left eye. I'd already lost the sight in my right eye as a teenager and had inherited some retinal problems from my late mother. I went through a kind of hinterland experience that I know many visually impaired people go through who are losing sight, and that is, you go through deteriorating partial sight to blindness, which in itself is hard enough, but also psychologically you're going through a transition where you don't know whether it's permanent or not. So I was initially blind, effectively, functionally blind, but not sure whether there was a chance of my sight coming back. So there was this period of sort of hope, rather desperate hope, which obviously sadly wasn't borne out. So I did live a little bit in sort of limbo, really, during sort of the age of, I suppose, 24, 25, when the sight went. So that was pretty devastating. But on the plus side, I lived with lovely housemates in South London. We had a flat and they looked after me well, kept my spirits up, lots of trips to the pub and other things, not just the pub. But, you know, so having that sort of friendship and comradeship was really helpful. I wasn't married at the time. I wasn't even in a relationship at the time. And actually, in a way, I'm rather glad I wasn't. So I had my good friends looking out for me. My work was at the Independent newspaper. I had a job in the advertising sales department. But the Independent were very good. And when they realised my sight wasn't returning, they kept me on salary and offered me a different type of job, which meant, it sounds very Mickey Mouse now, but at the time it was all I could do. It was literally answering phones and taking messages for a sort of busy little public relations department dealing with readers' inquiries and queries. So I had a little handheld tape machine and I would take messages and relay them to my colleague Helga, a German lady who was very kind at that time as well. So, you know, small beginnings, but yes, a very tough time. And there were moments where I felt able to deal with my blindness, and there were long passages where I felt unable to deal with it. I became very depressed and sought a sort of mental health support. I certainly used antidepressant medication to help with the worst phases of it. It was a very difficult time, but on the other hand, I was able to keep earning money, have lovely friendships and support networks there, and get my violin playing and going again and starting to learn pieces from memory, which was a great source of comfort at that time.
Yeah, because I suspect music must have been a great comfort for you, and also rediscovering music and being able to memorise music and play it again must have been a real thing for you at that time.
It was really important. And there were days before I went back to work when we were sort of hanging around wondering what was happening with the sight, where literally the only thing I could do during the day, because my friends were out at work all day, really, apart from listen to the radio, the obvious thing to do, was to play my violin. So I kind of rediscovered the violin. I'd neglected it a little bit before then and started getting my technique going again and playing some pieces. And I did sort of remember some pieces I had played in my sighted life. And then with the help of musical friends, started to commit a few pieces to memory and slowly, gradually build up a little bit of a repertoire, which I still have today. Because the amazing thing is, if you know, there is a sort of return on the investment, if you like, because although it takes months to memorize a piece like a concerto, you don't forget it quickly either. So the piece will live with you. So there are pieces today, such as the Bach that we're about to hear. I haven't performed that for 30 years, but I can pretty much still remember most of the notes.
And how did you feel playing that piece of Bach for double violin? How did you feel playing it again after, you know, sort of memorising it and being able to play it?
Yeah, well, it was just hugely exciting because I think I had written myself off in many ways. And I think, you know, the irony was, actually thinking about it, I didn't really do solo performances when I was sighted. It was only when I had the time through my early blind days to practice and get my violin playing going again, I actually think I've become a better violin player, which ironically has given me opportunities to do solo work. I mean, I'm not a professional, but I've done some work with professionals and performing the Bach concerto 30 years ago, which was only sort of a few months after my sight loss, maybe a year after my initial sight loss, was a landmark moment because I realised, A, I could do something with my brain and memorize music, and B, my technique through lots of steady practice that year, literally 30 years ago, Toby, 1992, meant my technique was reasonable enough, and again, I performed it. I played the second violin solo, and my former friend, still a friend, but from my youth orchestra days, Morven, who is a professional violinist, played the first violin solo, and she guided me on stage, and we rehearsed it, and it was all a very positive, affirming, sort of, wonderful experience. And it was a turning point, because I think, and it helped me come a little bit out of some of the depression and the funks I was having through early blindness, because I was doing something positive and realized I could do something.
Bach's Double Violin Concerto there, and another memorable performance for you too, Richard. Your next track is one that has helped you through, I think, some other sort of difficult times in your life. Times, as you say, in your sighted life and also in your blindness life. And a piece of music that really helped you to pull through some of those dark moments. When you are listening to music, because I know music has obviously, has kept you going through your life and helped you through those moments, does music sort of help you calm things down when you're listening to music? Does it take you to another place? Because I know a lot of composers have been inspired by landscape and the countryside, and even go on walks to inspire them to compose their music. And I just wondered if music takes you away from everything and takes you to a more calmer place.
It certainly can do. I don't think it's always taking, music isn't always necessarily taking me to a calmer place. Funnily enough, it's a good question, because, you know, sometimes, you know how people sometimes want to listen to upbeat music to make them feel more cheerful. And yes, I would say that's true. And particularly with this Sibelius, this next piece, the Fifth Symphony. But I also would say as well that music is an emotional lightning rod in a way for me, because if I'm feeling low, and this may sound self-indulgent and a bit negative, but actually, if you're feeling low sometimes, I don't want to hear cheerful music. Sometimes I want to wallow in feeling low and come out the other side and feel better as a result of that. But on the other hand, there are times when you may be feeling a bit low, but maybe not too low, where actually music can just pick you up and just lift you over the fence that you're struggling to get over. And that's when music is sort of inspirational, life-affirming, positive, and all the rest of it. Many pieces of music would fit that description, but I've chosen this well-known, I'm sure a lot of people will recognise this passage from Sibelius's Fifth Symphony. Sibelius had his own dark moments. He was a Finnish composer, and yeah, he struggled a lot with depression himself, but he wrote some really inspirational music. And this extraordinary sort of last movement of the Fifth Symphony, which I'm sure even if people don't follow classical music will recognise the tune and the themes, is really uplifting. And when you look a little bit into it, actually what inspired Sibelius for this particular passage with these French horns, triumphant French horns, apparently was the sight of swans flying overhead when Sibelius was sort of thinking about composing this symphony. He was actually in Gothenburg in Sweden at the time, and a flock of swans flew overhead, and it inspired him to write this really uplifting music. And it's just one of these sort of pieces. I've never performed it in either, so it's not something I've played personally in an orchestra, but every time I listen to it, my wife Liz loves it as well. It just gives us a certain, you can feel something, a quickening of the pulse and this sort of feeling of positivity going through your body. It's quite a visceral feeling.
Sibelius's Fifth Symphony there, and a real inspirational piece of music for you, Richard. We are now moving, I think, slightly away from classical music for your next track, Richard, and it's a ballad too. And it marks the time when you and your second wife, Liz, first met. How did you both meet? As I think this piece of music, this track by the Proclaimers, takes you back to those early days of meeting each other.
That is correct. The song we're about to hear, Sunshine on Leith, came out, I think, in the late 80s. Liz and I met later than that. But yeah, I mean, well, answer those two questions. We met, as people often do, because you're introduced by a friend. And Fred was having some friends around for dinner, and Liz was there, and I was there. And I think we had sort of briefly met and been introduced and said hello at some function, but that was it. So I was vaguely aware of her existence, but very fortunately for us, about a decade ago, as I said, we're at the friend's dinner party, and we sort of haven't looked back from there. It was just fantastic. It was very spontaneous, and you know, we're both very open with each other. We've both been married before and divorced, and we, you know, that's not easy for anyone. And you know, we were very, very grateful to have met each other. And not long after we met, we actually went to a local concert. It was I can't even remember the name of the group, but it was in Farnham, where we were living at the time. There was some sort of aging rock band. You know how rock bands get out and they're in their 70s and all grey haired. And I can't remember the group, and it wasn't very good. And I think we both decided, let's leave at the interval. But just as the interval started, they played some background music through the speakers, and they started playing this song, Sunshine on Leith by the Proclaimers, which I've dimly recalled from the late 80s when I was a student. And we both just sat there, unable to move, even though it was the interval time and everyone was getting up, getting a drink and stuff. And we wanted to escape, actually. I said, we can't go yet. We've got to listen to this. And it just, I don't know. It was either the distant memory of knowing the piece originally, then the lyrics of it, which is all about, you know, it's very hugely romantic, loving song and being grateful for each other. It just totally struck a chord with the fact that we had just met and very much in love. And we carry it with us. The lyrics particularly, you know, some of them are a bit visual, relating to blindness, a little touch of that in the lyrics, and feeling hurt, and but feeling previously hurt, but trying to get back on track. It just summed up our lives, really. So we carry it with us, and we listen to it at least once a year, at least on our wedding anniversary, and probably many more times than that as well.
Your beauty and kindness made tears clear my blindness. While I'm worth my room on this earth,
The Proclaimers there, and Sunshine on Leith, and a memorable track for you and Liz, Richard. For your next track, Richard, in a way, it is looking back on your life and a piece of music that really says something to you. And the piece, of course, is Nimrod from Elgar's Enigma Variations. And I believe you first played this piece of music in your late teens with the Bedford Youth Orchestra. And I wondered what was so memorable about that particular performance for you.
It's a wonderful work, Elgar's Enigma Variations, especially if one is English. We are English. There's something so English about Elgar. It's a bit of an obvious thing to say, but it does make you feel English when you listen to Elgar, point one. Point two, it's just an exquisite piece, and very happy memories of performing it when I was still fully sighted, or pretty much fully sighted, when I was sort of 18, 19. It was lovely. And I just remember luxuriating in it at the time and just enjoying it so much. The thrill of not just the first violin part, but as anyone knows, if they've played in an orchestra, the thrill of being, yes, playing a solo, or not a solo, but playing a first violin part along with other violinists, but being part of a bigger picture, that is the full orchestra, because Elgar was such an amazing orchestrator, you know, his horn parts and his other, he was just fantastic. So that's a privilege in itself. That could have been the end of the story. Then, 2009, so 13 years ago, I've been blind many years, and my youth orchestra in Bedford was having a bit of a reunion concert, and I wasn't invited to play, or I could have put myself forward to play, but I thought, well, I can't play in an orchestra anymore, because obviously I can't read the notes, I wouldn't have time to memorize the music. But then I realized one of the pieces on the program was the Enigma Variations, and I contacted the organizer and said, and they realized by now I was blind, but I said, any chance I could play, I could probably memorize most of the notes or remember a good deal of those notes, and I could brush up on the others I don't know with the help of Muriel again, the all-important Muriel. And they said, well, yeah, great idea. So to cut a long story short, there I was in the orchestra in my sort of early 40s playing the first violin part of the Elgar Enigma variations that I had played sort of, you know, 30 years previously or something, and loving it, if not as much, probably even more, because I, whilst my violin playing, as we've discussed, got going in my blind life, it was very much solo performance work, not orchestral work, for the reasons I've just said, you know, learning in sort of all the bits and pieces of orchestral music would be very difficult to do, to memorize it and then sit in an orchestra. But I did do it for this one piece, given I had the advantage of already knowing it and loving it quite well, which helped. And so so we performed it, and I absolutely loved it. I remember the dress rehearsal playing awfully, really badly, because I was at the back of the first violins and there was a sort of French horn blasting my ear out behind me. Found it a bit off-putting, and my bow was bouncing, and it just didn't feel very good. And then come the concert, I was felt completely relaxed and serene, and I think I played pretty much every note and loved it. And again, is that the end of the story? Well, not quite, because on my 50th birthday, 5 years ago or so, Liz and I were in France with Topper, my third and lovely RIP Topper, beautiful black Labrador guide dog. And for my 50th birthday, Liz was treating me to a stay in Saint-Emilion, which is a beautiful wine town just outside Bordeaux. And we were staying there, and I woke up on the morning of my 50th birthday feeling kind of, wow, it's my 50th birthday. But I didn't want to disturb Liz because she was sleeping, and Topper, judging by the snoring, foot of the bed was doing, not on the bed, I hasten to say, on the floor, was also asleep. And so I thought, okay, what shall I do? And I had my iPhone with me with music on. I thought, I fancy listening to Nimrod. So I listened to it, you know, carefully trying not to wake Liz and Topper up, and listened to the beautiful variation before Nimrod. Is this very positive, beautiful variation that ends in G major, lovely bright G major key. And then the miracle of Nimrod is that the first violins hold the G of G major like a bridge. No one else plays, you just hear the G, and then that becomes an E flat major chord, which is the key of Nimrod, the next variation. And as I was listening to this, my heart was sort of almost stopping in my chest. It's such an amazing moment. And then to my utter astonishment, in the background, the church, which we'd heard the night before, the old church in Saint-Emilion, started chiming. It started chiming in perfect rhythm, 4-4 crotchet beats, on as that long G was being held, suspended into Nimrod. Not only that, it was chiming a G, the same note as the violin. So the church was in time and in tune, and that introduced the Nimrod. And I just nearly died of emotional something. I just couldn't believe this was all happening on the morning of my 50th birthday.
Nimrod from Elgar's Enigma Variations there, and a wonderful and moving piece of music too. Richard, we now come to your final track, the one that you might like to pass on to others that maybe might give people hope for the future. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
My final piece, Toby, and if you like my going out track or recommendation track for everyone else, is Mozart again. Not just because my father loved Mozart so much, although it's rather lovely that he did, but the happiness it brings, because I would say generally Mozart has this ability to make music sound easy, but actually it's really difficult to play, as in the Sinfonia Concertante that we heard earlier. And the piece I'm choosing is one of his 26, yes, you did hear correctly, 26 piano concertos, and it's actually almost the last one, his 25th piano concerto in C major. This is such a triumphant piece of music. It's in a very positive key of C major. It's very bright. And it's not just the piece of music. It is actually this recording. It is just a magical, magical, completely balanced, rounded piano concerto. So not only is the piece extraordinary, but this live recording with Marta Argerich, Claudia Abbado and Orchestra Mozart is just sublime. And it would be absolutely my recommendation to anyone, if you want to get to know Mozart and Mozart piano concertos, listen to this.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Richard Lane, for sharing your Tracks of My Life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Toby, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, and thank you everyone listening so much. I hope you found it an interesting journey.